Hello, everyone, and welcome to More of the Mises, guys. And today we have a very special interview with one of the, I call them lore masters of Transformers, Simon Furman. And welcome, Simon.
Hi there, glad to be here.
Yeah,
Thanks for
thank you.
inviting me.
Yeah, by the way, I found out recently you and Wildman have started your own podcast.
Yeah, that's right. We decided, given it's the 40th anniversary year, it would be great just to reminisce, I guess, and go right back to our respective beginnings on the brand in our careers. So yeah, we started on The Rest Is Giant Robots, and I think we're up to episode four now.
That's all that is much.
Very nice.
And that's actually really nice. One of the things I've been able to talk to Buzz Dixon and Michael Charles Hill, and the stories from the earlier days of the franchise. And I realize a lot of people didn't think it was going to be a 40-year-old legacy brand or IP. But the stories are really some of the best parts of talking to all of you who've been in the business so long, because we were growing up with it, so we didn't get to we weren't in on that side of it. So hearing the stories is really the best part to me. So definitely, I'm glad, and I'll put a link to your podcast in the show notes for this here.
Perfect, thank you.
You're very
And
welcome.
I mean, it's great, and you're right. We none of us thought 40 years ago, or whenever we respectively got involved, that we'd still be here 40 years later talking about it. You it it was it was very much my first, or one of my first, script writing jobs. So I absolutely had no idea we'd get to where we are now.
And I mean, honestly, we just had the like you're saying, we just hit the 40th anniversary of the book of the comic coming out. And it just seems crazy to me. Everything's lining up, and I don't know. I realize that I'm but yeah quite a well I'm a bit younger than you are. So whenever I see these things go, I'm like, wow, it's been that long already, and it just doesn't seem like it to me. It seems surreal, and it's almost one of those feelings like when I was growing up, and the only big, I guess, franchise fandom that I really heard about were your Star Trek, your Trekkies, Star Wars fans. I didn't expect Transformers, and I'll be honest, to be one of those franchises that has such a big fan base and even bigger every year.
Well, neither did we. And, it was a great surprise to us when we went to, I think it was BotCon in 1997, to discover there was this fan base. We didn't know, that's for sure. We used to get readers writing into the comic. We used to address readers' letters. Very occasionally, we might have a signing event. But generally, we didn't really know there was a certainly enduring fan base.
Definitely that. And speaking of that, I mean, I was talking to Boo about the latest feature film, the Transformers 1. I know you want to talk to you about that.
Oh yeah, I was curious. Have you got to see the film yet?
I haven't yet. I'm not even totally sure it's been released here in the
Oh, that's
UK.
right. It's not in the UK
Oh.
yet. You're correct.
So
Yeah.
no,
I don't want to spoil anything for you then.
Oh, no. I was all geared up to go see it this week, but yeah, it doesn't appear to be on yet. So, but I've heard very good general rumbles and vibe from it, which is good to hear.
Oh yeah, we loved it, and you'll recognize a lot of the stuff because a lot of the stuff is things you created.
Yeah.
I mean, there's stuff about the 13 primes and Primus, and everything is worked into it. And I'm just curious, how do you feel about the fact that there was two competing creation stories for Transformers? There's Quintessons and Primus, and your version of it has pretty much supplanted the Quintesson. Like, everybody leans on Primus now. They like Primus.
Yeah, I mean, I think, it was funny. It was, I didn't have strong feelings about the animated TV show one way or another. I was slightly older than it was pitched at, so I looked at it in one way, and it never quite, the only thing I never quite got or liked was the idea that the Transformers were kind of created by another robotic race.
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed to somehow diminish them, that they were creations of someone else. And you know, and when there didn't seem to be that kind of need to take anything in the cartoon show as canon, you know, it was nice to be able to just say, let's do something bigger, grander, something that makes the Transformers themselves seem, you know, part of the kind of almost universal fabric, you know, that
Right.
there's weight to them. So yeah, you know, we were very happy to do our own version of this. And yeah, you know, obviously it's lovely that successive, you know, comic and TV storylines have kind of picked up the whole Primus 13 angle.
Yeah, which is
Yeah,
not.
it's got to make you proud to see that, you know, the things you just kind of pulled out of nothing has become like the dominant story. Over the,
Sure,
you know,
you know.
decades.
We were helped, of course, by the animated movie and the whole, you know, Unicron thing. You know, that was it, that just felt big and epic, and you know, like, you know, it from an age, bygone age. And I think that was the springboard we used very much to craft that sort of more mythological backstory. You know, I was a big fan of the work of Stanley and Jack Kirby when they would do those massive cosmic Thor stories or Fantastic Four, and you had Galactus, you had Ego, the living planet, and it just felt, you know, huge and, you know, had impact across a whole universe. And I think that was what we were channeling, trying to get some of that grandeur to the origin.
Well, it succeeded.
Yeah, and even in the different storylines in the comics, depending on which I guess title you're working on, it still has a successive grandeur because of the basis you put down all those years ago, which is really nice. It almost like it took a Unicron in a much further, I guess a more mythological way than the movie or you know obviously the show even did. It just at one point I almost felt like they just thought he was just a big transformer and nothing more grand than that, which seemed like you said kind of diminishes it.
And it's nice that, you know, we had this concept of something before called the One, which seems to be again sort of dripping down through the successive iterations of Transformers, which is nice.
Right. Yeah, it brought, like you said, it brought a more mythological aspect to it. Like you can compare it to like Greek mythology with the Titans, and you know you have Zoroastrianism with the duality of like Angra Manu and the Ahura Mazda.
Yeah, you know, I mean,
Yeah.
again, getting back to the Marvel analogy, we loved, you know, that sort of idea of, you know, those massive beings. What are they called?
The
The Celestials?
Celestials?
Celestials, yes, that's it.
Yes.
You know, again, that kind of thing, that's something that just dwarfed even, you know, the giant robots of the Transformers. So that idea of just making it bigger, broader, you know, it all stemmed a lot from that sort of Marvel, you know, cosmic universe.
Definitely. You know, I feel almost feel like kind of got ahead of ourselves. We've talked about this before, but I can't wonder for everyone else who may be listening. Can you really tell us how you got started with in the business, especially you know, like being introduced to Transformers? I know we've talked about this before, but I think people, you know, who haven't talked to you or listened to you on interviews or at conventions may be kind of curious.
Sure, you know, I was, you know, I worked behind the scenes in the editorial side on comics before I ever started script writing. So I was working for a company called IPC Magazines here in the UK. They did a lot of, you know, quote unquote kids comics, 2000 AD, Battle, other, you know, sort of UK comics. And I worked, you know, first of all, just generally for the company. So I got a kind of feel for a lot of the editorial offices. And then I worked specifically on a small comic, short-lived comic called Scream, which lasted only 15 issues. But it was a kids' creepy, you know, sort of ghoulish story weekly. And that was where I first got to do some writing, normally through necessity, where we had something we needed to get done very quickly, or a writer had let us down, or we just needed, in one case, a story wrapped up really, really quickly. And, I was normally drafted in at the last minute just to do a script. Now, it's great. It's kind of taught me how to punch something out to deadline, which was good. And these were 5 or 6 page stories each episode. So again, you had to be pretty much, pack a lot in and get your story told. So it was all good stuff for when I got asked, that my editor on screen was a guy called Ian Rimmer. And Ian moved to Marvel UK after Scream folded, and a few months later called me up to say, "Would you like to come and meet Sheila Cranner? She's the editor of a new comic and they're looking for writers." So, with no preconceptions, I went into the Marvel offices and was handed a massive stack of reference, probably black and white Xeroxes of the first few American issues, toy pack art, all sorts of things, and told to come away with, go away and come up with self-contained stories that could sit in between the runs of the American Marvel story. Basically, we were weekly, well, fortnightly, then weekly. The American comic was monthly. So very quickly, we'd have run out of reprint material. So yeah, I was drafted in and I just sat down with all this reference, looked at Bob Budiansky's, all the character profiles that we had. And it was great. It was just like, okay, well, let's use these characters. They're maybe not as central to the story as others. And just tell a little self-contained story. And that was The Enemy Within. And it all rolled out of that, really. But again, I thought it might be one or two I got out of this, but it just kept rolling. And then eventually I was on staff at Marvel. And yeah, I was on staff and working, as a freelancer as well. So yeah, it just all gathered momentum really quickly.
Nice. And yeah, we found a one of the issues of Scream. It's it, yeah, like you said, they're just fun little creepy stories for young adults, kids, and that's actually it's they're great. Still hold up. It really reminds me of the anthologies books, like your creep show style older comics, and yeah, really nice.
Oh yeah, I read a few of them. I really loved the Dracula file where you had Dracula having to sleep in the bathtub. That cracked me up. That was great.
We had some fun. That particular story I literally wrote overnight because I was on, again, I was working a 9 to 5, commuting into the office, and that was one where we literally needed it the second day, the next day. So I had to, have something to eat, sit up till all hours finishing that story. But again, it was good training for hitting a deadline, whatever. So that was great fun. And Scream is also 40 years old this year, and they've just released a massive hardback collection of all the Scream stories.
Oh,
So
great.
that's really cool as well. All anniversaries this year.
It's a big
Wow.
year.
Your first story for them that you wrote, it was the werewolf story, right? Is that
Yeah,
correct? Yeah.
it is. I wrote that, but actually that wasn't the first that got published. The Library of Death were these little one-off stories that
Right.
were generally, we had a rolling amount of those. So, we would send writers off, come up with a story, and we'd always have a few on file. So I started the werewolf story just thinking, well, that will get published whenever it gets published. But in the meantime, the series that I was asked to kind of rush complete, if you like, was called Terror of the Cats. And
Yes.
that was a strange one. The management, who were a little jumpy about Scream anyway, really took exception to something about that story, as innocuous as it seems today. And they wanted it wrapped up and out of the comic as soon as possible. So I was given the job of jumping in after the writer who'd started it and finishing off in 4 weekly installments. So that actually saw print before my werewolf story.
Yeah, that's actually
Yeah.
it's I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just saying, yeah, I remember reading that one first. But yeah, I just love the twist in the werewolf story. I mean, you hit the ground running with that one.
And absolutely, and I had Steve Dillon as the artist on it, you know, the
Oh
late
yeah.
Dillon, and you know, what a way to start, you know, a sort of real pro artist like that drawing your stuff.
Yeah, actually, I love Steve Dillon's work. I enjoyed reading Hellblazer, and you know, I know he did a lot of work on there. It, actually, or was it I'm sorry, Preacher.
Well, but also Hellblazer, he
Yeah,
did as
Hellblazer.
well.
In the work, I mean, some of the fantastic artists that I was fans of already had worked on the UK Marvel book. You know, he had John Ridgway. Beautiful art there as well. So that's it's really interesting to go back and see them, and that you recognize their style also. And like, I wonder if that's this is who I think it is. So yeah, you know, you said, you know, you hit the ground running with fantastic talent in there. So that definitely probably helped a lot.
Yep, definitely.
So you know, going back to the Transformers book, you after you took over both sides of the Marvel Transformers book, I mean, how difficult was it to keep in mind that there was so much that American fans had not seen while also writing the US Marvel portion.
Yeah, I mean, when we were just working on the UK stuff, you know, it got easier for us once we did Target 2006, and we didn't have to be so slavishly bound to what the American storyline might be doing. We were doing a lot of second guessing and hopefully getting advanced plots and storylines. But the Target 2006, because we had the future cast, freed us up a lot to do our own stories and, you know, make them a bit more impactful and meaningful, if you like, you know, that they had their own weight. And, you know, again, that's where ultimately we dropped the origin of the Transformers into that strand of storylines, which featured Unicron and then introduced Primus. So that was all great. And then by the time I was writing the American series, really the UK storylines had gone down to 5-page black and white short stories. And so even though I tried a couple of experimental slight crossovers, it never really happened. You know, we couldn't get the scheduling of the stories to match, and it probably just confused a lot of the American readers. So we gave up on that pretty quickly.
Yeah, definitely see that.
What was it like doing double duty when you were writing for both sides?
Yeah, they were both, like I say, they were both very different beasts by then. I think, you know, it would have been strange if we'd still been doing big 11-page mini epics in the UK. And maybe that could have more dovetailed, but these 5 pages had to be fairly short and sweet, and a lot of them nowadays, you look at them and they seem slightly out of continuity, out of main continuity, because it was very difficult to, you know, there's a whole sort of strand of this group of Autobots called Earth Force in the little 5-page black and whites. But really, that doesn't really, it's very hard to reconcile that with what was going on in the US book. So, you know, again, we never thought this would be ever analyzed in decades to come. So we just thought, oh, well, it doesn't really matter that much. And, but of course, yeah, we have got two slightly different continuity strands.
You had some great stories in Earth Force too. I love the one where you have Soundwave as the mole and he pins it on Wild Rider and gets him killed for it.
Yeah, they, you know, they were fun to do, and they
Yeah.
kind of harked back to what I'd started doing, those short, punchy, in and out stories, you know, almost with a punchline, you know, not exactly, but it's more or less in 5 pages. You've got to drop people into the middle of a story, almost slight recap possibly, and then bam, you've got your little sort of stinger at the end or something. So, it was only doing, I think, what I'd started out doing, which was, these neat, compact, but hopefully with a little bit of a punch stories.
Right. Reading the Scream comics that you worked on, it seemed, reminded me a lot of what Earthforce was, like the way they were put together.
Yeah, it is. It's you've got a limited amount of pages, so you can't really, there's no here's a lovely splash page because you really haven't got the latitude for that. You've got to, pretty much do the setup of everything on the first few panels of the story. So, there's one where basically, the one that often people remember is this one with Mechanibals in it and Dreadwind and Darkwing. And basically, it's just Dreadwind and Darkwing in a bar bitching about how rubbish their lives are and how much has gone wrong. And then, around them, something else is happening that they even don't even notice through the course of the story. So that when they get up, somewhat inebriated, let's say, just look around and the whole storyline has kind of happened in the background around them. So, it was that sort of little, you just had to be a little clever with them. But, there was no room for preamble or, great swathes of character building. You just had to sort of nail it as quickly as possible.
And with you were having to use other characters that they really weren't using in the American stories, gave us some of the I guess more memorable teams. I mean, that's you look at their records. I mean, that became one of the favorite team setups, which is something that was a continuous arc through the UK books, and it really featured a lot of the characters that they didn't see a lot of over here in the American comic.
Yeah, and that of course is deliberate because, we were forever looking for the characters that Bob hadn't forgotten but hadn't been able to squeeze into the ongoing US series. So a lot of literally almost every wrecker, apart from the ones we made up, are basically characters that were in the first few waves of G1. But Bob hadn't managed to squeeze in. So we were always looking for almost Bob's cast-offs, if you like, either the characters who had been in the story, like the Dinobots, and then get moved out for a while, or just characters he hadn't managed to fit in, like the Triple Changers.
Yeah,
Right.
definitely.
And they've been doing these toy capsules like for Amazon, like they did the Wreckers last year, and this year it's the Mayhems.
Yes, yeah, I
So
saw that. It's great. I love that all these things. Amazingly, they did Emirate Zaran and Flame as a two-pack.
yeah, finally.
You say finally, but wow, almost more obscure, I can't imagine, especially Flame, who was only in something like two of the UK issues in
Right.
full role. So, but kind of, great. I love it. I love that these characters. Literally never seem to die. They just kind of roll on and on.
I was kind of hoping they'd give us a zombie impactor.
Oh,
That too.
that would
And
that
then
really.
next year's whole theme is the 13 Primes.
Yes, so I hear, which is
Yeah.
really nice. That's great. And yeah, I mean, The Fallen was very much a kind of another one of those, oh, let's have the mythological sort of, fallen angel, if you like, out of that sort of 13. And yeah, it's all tapping into, other than the, those Marvel comic cosmic things. I was always looking slightly at, religions and beliefs and taking some of those, almost staples out of those and moving them over into the sort of your sci-fi Transformers setting.
Right, it had a very Paradise Lost feel to the
Yes.
Fallen. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly that. I mean, these are age-old stories, and somebody once said there are, only so many stories. They're just told in different ways. And I definitely look to those archetype stories when I was writing Transformers.
Oh yeah, those are, classic tropes that, it's just make up good storytelling that we've been using since it was just oral stories in front of campfires.
Yeah, exactly
Yeah.
that.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite usages of this is like the hero's journey. You have to have certain things in the hero's journey. And while like in the 86 animated movie, I'm always a defender of the path they took for Hot Rod, because it was the hero's journey. The mentor has to die, and then the new hero rides up. And I enjoy seeing actually my original love was literature, but that didn't work out for my career. So whenever I see you can call them tropes, but I mean they're classical story structures, but with our favorite characters or our favorite properties put into it, it gives it a little more gravitas to me.
Yeah, I mean, there are underpinning things, in any bit of storytelling, be it a novel, a movie, screenplay, a comic, and you have to, we were taught a lot by, the Marvel editor in chief of US Marvel, who just would take us through, well, here's the thing to remember with a comic. Every comic may be somebody's first issue. It may say issue 76, but they may be picking it up off the newsstand or whatever, and they need to know where they are with this character. You can't just plunge them in and forget about that. So, I think I still do that a lot in storytelling. I try and, without making it laborious recaps or anything, just make sure everybody knows who everybody is and why they're doing what to each other. Even if that means a certain amount of repetition, the trade, everyone writes for the trade now and maybe doesn't do that as much, but I still try and make every single issue somewhat self-sustaining so that you get something out of it. Maybe part three of six, but within it, there's a spine of a story that means something, that moves the story along, that moves the characters along. Even if it's backwards, but it's just, that there's something substantial in each issue was again part of that thing that the likes of Jim Shooter and Tom DeFalco really sort of drilled into us.
Right, like the smaller arcs that build to a larger I guess, overarching story.
That's where, I mean, I loved, I'm the creature of my influence as much as anyone, and when it came to comics, I loved, Alan Moore's use of language and how he would marry picture and dialogue or picture and caption so cleverly. And then Chris Claremont's X-Men, I loved how he juggled subplots, how he juggled a group dynamic, how there were always two or three building subplots in the back. There's a complete story there, but meanwhile, there's mastermind or something lurking in the shadows in the background doing things. And I love that idea. And again, that became very much a part of my writing, this always this foreshadowing, or there's something else coming along.
Yeah, I think honestly the having let's say I put in quotes villains, they're not always villains though, that maybe anti-heroes that actually have their own ambitions, their own reason for doing things, makes it just a so much better story. No one really likes a one-dimensional character that you can plug into anything. So whenever you have these small arcs, when you have characters who have stakes or have ambitions, it makes it a more believable story. And it honestly, I think is one of the reasons why a lot of the UK stories, especially as you went on, it produced so many memorable characters. Like we're talking about Zeron or I mean the Wreckers. You have all these inner group dynamics. And so yeah, having those ambitions and those stakes actually I think helped a lot with those stories.
Yeah,
So
I mean,
definitely.
whether it's heroes or villains, again, we were always taught there has to be something that you recognize yourself in those, sort of it may be something, one of those emotions we don't, or sort of, parts of ourselves we dislike, but you've always got to say, look, this is somewhat reflective of you, the reader, or the human condition, or something. You know, there's got to be, no matter how grand sci-fi, mega epic it is, you know, it's always got to be sort of pulled back to that kind of, it relates somehow to the reader's own life, own, you know, ambitions, you know, issues, whatever you want to call it. I think there was always that kind of think about, you know, what this means to the person reading it.
Definitely. But so we've all kind of in the if we've been in the fandom for any period of time, we've heard the stories and the rumors about what you actually had planned for the Generation 2 comic. And that was one of those moments where I you could see you're trying to get a lot of content in just those 12 issues. But were you able to lay out properly all the story elements in other publications of Transformers over the years, the ones you weren't able to use in Generation 2?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we got to use some things that maybe were unused concepts when we got to Regeneration One, because that was almost like, you know, we were introducing G2 elements into that storyline. But, you know, I mean, the thing with Generation Two was we always, you know, from conception, really, we always thought, right, we're going to. From what we thought of as Generation One, we're just going to pull the camera back. And it's like, oh, that's happening there, but all this stuff has been happening over here as well. And the idea was, with each sort of 12 issue storyline arc, if that's how we'd got with it, was to keep pulling back that camera. So every time it's like, you know, the threat of the first one is Geaxus and the Swarm. The second one was going to be the Liege Maximo and this sort of, you know, mass homogenizing of planets that, you know, that we touch on in Regeneration One. But it was, you know, that was the idea. It was always, the scope was always going to be bigger. What you thought you knew was only part of the bigger picture. And, you know, it's just a shame we never really got to keep pulling that camera back.
Yeah, it almost seems like the characters in the original run of I would say the G1 run of comics, they were essentially Dredwin and Darkwing in the tavern while everything else is happening outside. So that was, yeah, that's really neat to see that. And yeah, you can definitely tell the way it ended with Rook standing in front of Legio Maxima, how much bigger things were going to be if y'all had the chance.
Yeah, it's a shame we never got to do more. You know, it's you know, even retrospectively, I'm not the biggest fan of looking back at my stuff, but I kind of enjoyed looking back at G2. You know, there were some big ideas in there, and it's lovely that Bob Forward and Larry DiTillio took the swarm idea and created the Vok out of that. So, you know, it's nice that it had a sort of resonance with people. And, you know, I wish we could have, I wish Derek Yanniger, and this is no offense to the other artists, but I wish he could have drawn the whole thing, because I loved his stuff. And it seemed to be, that was G2 to me, his art. It just looks spiky and edgy, and you know,
100%.
and some 90s.
Well, and that was the first look we got at Transformers as an adult comic.
Right, you know.
Like what we have now, you know, from Dreamwave and IDW and now Skybound, you know, it's like a serious, you know, violent comic. And G2 was really the story that started that. I mean, first couple of pages, you know, you've got the shock troopers going through and killing Cybertronians.
Yeah, I mean,
Yeah.
you know, some of that was a product of that vibe that was around in comics in the 90s. You know, everything was, you know, big shoulder pads and bullet belts and anti-heroes. So, you know, we were very much, I think, of the time, if you like. But yeah, you know, there was a conscious decision there as well to maybe think, well, look, the fans of the original book, if they're going to come back to this, maybe they need it to be a little edgier, a little, you know, more grown up. And, you know, right down to the front cover line, which was, this is not your father's Autobot. You know, it's just, it had a kind of, you know, this is something a little different. And we tried to go with that flow a lot.
Yeah, it felt like the book grew up with us at that point.
Yeah, and yet we still had zero idea that there would be anything more beyond that. I still thought, what, as much as I put It Never Ends at the end of the for the original Marvel series, when we got to the end of G2, I just thought, well, look, that's it. That is the end of Transformers. But as I say, here we are.
Yeah, and it was actually in the G2 era there that I first got online on the internet. It was around 94. And the reason I even got online was to look up Transformers stuff. Someone said, hey, there's Transformers stuff on this internet thing. And
And there were these fledgling kind of news group communities growing out there, and the first BotCon was, I think, 94. So
yes.
it was all that sort of early, really early interconnectivity that jump started the fandom, I think.
Yeah,
Oh,
definitely.
absolutely. I was there. I was lurking more on the Alt Toys Transformers. But yeah, it was pretty active. And it was just wild to see how everybody could just come together and share information. And, it helped us hunt down the comics and everything too.
Sure.
Yeah, and it's neat. A lot of those, a lot of the people from those days who have worked, maybe did little fanzines or things like that, have retained through the fandom. Even we had to have one of the older people who did a fanzine, Tony Buchanan, has come back and he's started doing PDFs of it now instead of sending out things in the mail. So having all these things, it's almost like the property does a nice refresh every so often, but it still retains all the core values. And like Boo was saying, you the it feels like the property has grown up with us, but at the same time you also have newer things that bring in younger people, like the Earthspark, like, I mean, the Rescue Bots. It was a show for really little kids. And but there's something for everyone. I think it's one of the reasons it's really kept going nicely.
Yeah, and it does, as you say, reinvent itself. It's the most transformable of franchises. It really is. And yeah, and every now and then it just gets, a new version, but it doesn't seem to sort of take away from, the core of it all. It just sort of draws on the same elements and represents them. So, you can look at Earthspark and you see all the lineage of Transformers in that, from the oldest to the more recent. Yet, it's its own thing as well. So, I think that's the great thing about Transformers. It will keep reinventing itself.
Evidently. So when you in the original story of the G1 story, with having the evil Matrix entity, that same kind of spiky look, and Legion Maximo had the same similar look. Was that intentional?
I don't think so. It might
Oh.
just have been that, they were both drawn by Jeff Senior, who had that kind of style. I mean, I'm pretty sure Jeff drew the Liege Maximo on that final page, and he had done the Matrix kind of creature that sort of from the Matrix Quest storyline. So yeah, it may just have been stylistically that was just Jeff's influence on it.
That makes sense. Well, Abu, yeah,
So,
anything you want to add there?
yeah, when you were working on Beast Wars, you got to work on the episode that actually named the Decepticon ship, the Nemesis. Where did the name come from? Did that come from Bob and Larry, or was that
Yeah,
in the
I'm pretty sure that Nemesis name must have been in an original pitch. Bob's got that treatment that was put together by Jim Shooter and noodled around with by at least one other editor, and then Bob came in. And I'm pretty sure that, even things like in the UK, we name the computer on board the Ark as Auntie, as a sort of acronym we never got round to explaining until much later. But that Auntie was, believe it or not, the original name of the spacecraft. It wasn't the Ark originally. In the original treatment, you can see Auntie as being crossed out. And so, we were always looking for these little things. And The Nemesis, I assume, was mentioned somewhere, even though it never made it into anything. Because when you look at Target 2006, I'm pretty sure that we call we there's a bit where they destroy the still orbiting spacecraft, the Decepticon spacecraft, with a massive gun they're going to use on Unicron. And I'm pretty sure we named it back then. And I just took that name, and given the opportunity, we dropped it into Beast Wars as to give it its more formal, christening.
Oh, excellent.
Okay. So you mentioned a lot of people that you looked up to, and a lot of art and artists that that influenced your style of writing. Were there particular mentors that you looked up to and you may have gotten to work with?
I mean, I was, generally in awe of, I grew up, with British comics, and then when I was getting back into comics, there was 2000 AD, and the creators on that, uniformly, again, in this very limited 5-page, 6-page chunk format, producing the most incredible visionary, work. You only have to look at some of the first 100 issues of 2000 AD to see the work of John Wagner, Alan Grant, Dave Gibbons, Alan Moore, and on and on and on. And, the amount of creativity in there, and just how, sharp and well observed and satirical. It had that British comics thing where it was very rarely superheroes, and even the sort of the storylines were laced with s political subtext, or real world context that you either got as an older reader or just enjoyed the weirdness of as a younger reader. But and I loved all that, and I think that's what that British comics thing brought to when Vertigo Comics, the DC imprint, started hoovering up a lot of British talent. I think that's what they wanted, that darker, more subversive, slightly, not exactly tongue in cheek, but sort of, targeted barbs at things you can recognize and appreciate as an adult rather than just a kid reading comics. So yeah, I think those creators, those British early 2000 AD creators, I learned a lot from. I used to, when I was in and out of the IPC offices of the comics, ask to see original scripts, and I would read John Wagner's Judge Dredd scripts, and they were amazingly lean and mean. It would just be Dredd on bike, Dredd shoots perp. Dredd does, and it was that was it. He just trusted the artist to do their thing with it without calling a mid shot or a close up or a whatever. And I loved that. But then I would look at Pat Mills' scripts for Nemesis or any of his other work for 2000 AD or Alan Moore's, and they were immensely detailed and researched, and so I found my own sort of middle ground with that, of being terse and punchy when I needed to be, and get the story rolling and trust the artist. But when, you're trying to set up something across a whole issue with a payoff, putting in the detail for the artist to follow.
Right. And as we've been going through the UK comics, that's what we've been doing in the podcast, is we've been going just book by book. We're seeing there's a lot of talent that's pulled from 2000 AD into the Transformers UK.
I mean, often there were almost two strands. You would have the creators who worked for 2000 AD, or the creators who worked for Marvel UK. But then, of course, there was a bit of back and two. So, we employed people like Barry Kitson and Will Simpson, who then moved on to 2000 AD, and then we would bring in other new talent. Brian Hitch started with doing stuff for Action Force and then Transformers. So we were always, there was a rolling We had a lot of big pool of artists we needed to for a weekly comic. Very rarely did we have the luxury of giving a full 22 pages to one artist. But that was just great in another way because it meant we had a variety of styles. We were always looking for new artists to come in. So if Will, say, Will Simpson went off to 2000 AD, we had other artists we could give their start to. We would bring in a Lee Sullivan or an Andrew Wildman. And it was great because it just meant that we were bringing, we had such a large talent pool of great artists by the end. And some of them, stuck with Marvel more because they saw their future. Part of what we've been talking about in the podcast, Andrew and I, is how, a lot of us who were working for Marvel UK had one eye on working for Marvel US. So this was a progression that we would get ourselves immersed in Marvel UK, and that would open doors at Marvel US. And to a large extent, it worked for all of us. Lee Sullivan, myself, Andrew Wildman, Richard Starkings, many ended up working for Marvel, the parent company, as opposed to Marvel, the UK subdivision. And that was great. It just meant, that flow went through, and the 2000 AD side tended weirdly to go to DC and Vertigo. That seemed to be their trajectory. So, obviously there's crossovers both ways, but it was nice that there was that route for people to take, or routes.
When you got transferred over to Marvel US on Transformers, did that open the door for a lot of the British artists to come over to New York?
It certainly did. I mean, again, Andrew and I talk about this, that, as and when I could, my default was, can we bring in this UK artist? So when Jose Delbo, who was drawing the Transformers comic, was needed to draw Brute Force, I suggested Jeff Senior more or less fill in for issues. And Don Daly, who was the editor at the time, was happy with that. And then we got to another point where we needed, Jose wasn't really coming back to the book, so we needed another regular artist. And Don wanted another guy whose name escaped, Dwayne Turner, to come in and do one issue to see whether he was a fit. And that was issue 68. And I don't think any of us felt that Dwayne, who was a great artist, was kind of the right fit for the robots. But then it just gave me an opportunity to say, well, there's Andrew Wildman, who I've worked with in the UK. We could get him to come in, and the rest is history. And Lee, Sullivan got his connections and was working on RoboCop and Tech War for Marvel US. So yeah, it was just generally, yes, it helped. Once somebody got in, then you could bring other people in or recommend to the editors. So yeah, it helped, and we all helped each other.
I remember that issue. That was the Neo Knights
That's
introduction.
the one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's just a sort of strange, the style is so jarring, it just didn't seem to kind of flow between, the previous issue, which was Jose, and the next issue, which was Andrew. So, but I mean, Don Daly, give him his due, he just said, no, okay, this isn't working out. And I don't think it was working out for Dwayne either. I'm not totally sure. He sort of really dug doing Transformers, but Andrew was keen and very ready to sort of jump in, and he basically saw the book out, apart from one fill-in by Jeff when we got to the 75th issue. It was Andrew all the way.
It's like you needed a special kind of artist that could go from your typical superhero drawings to robots.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Andrew bought that. I'm sure Andrew would tell you this as well, that he really wanted to draw humans, superheroes, whatever. So that's why the Transformers tend to have more human characteristics in his drawing. They tend to be a little fleshier looking in the face, and they maybe have teeth and drool and things like that. So, but it was fine. What we wanted more than anything on the book was consistency. And, Andrew really provided that. And especially once he was teamed up with Stephen Baskerville, it was like, that's it. We had our sort of nice, continuous flow to the art, which was great.
Right. I believe he said once that he drew men in armor, basically, was his the way he handled Transformers. And it worked. I liked it.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it is. Again, if you listen to The Rest Is Giant Robots, Andrew talks at length about how when he came onto the book, the Marvel style wanted him to make the robots more like metallic, hard-edged characters. And, gradually, bit by bit, he just sort of reimposed his own style, and everyone seemed to really like it.
Yeah, well,
Yeah, they were
you know.
really. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was about to say, there was very, I think it sometimes some the way the story was going, the anthropomorphizing the robots to make them seem more human, maybe more approachable.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, everybody draws Transformers in a different way, but I think that humanizing element has played through to sort of more modern Transformers artists who don't draw them in that sort of slightly boxy way that sometimes the US comic artists, were doing. They were just literally taking, the animation models and putting them in comics. But I think the UK style, because we had such a wide range of different styles, anything went. We had an artist called Dan Reed on the UK comic who literally, never drew a straight line in his life, I don't think. And that's not criticizing Dan. That was his style. Everything was flowy and bendy, and okay, it didn't seem to matter. There was Kirby crackle all over the place whenever they transformed. So, it was just we had so many different styles that there was no wrong or right one. It was just, if you can make it work, great. And for the most part, all the artists really did.
Yeah, definitely. I'm like, we're kind of running lower on time here, but I wanted to ask you about some of the self-published projects you've worked on, though. First of all, a crime noir graphic novel called 5 Points.
It's been nice to be able to do a few of my own projects, which never seem to have had time for. So Jeff Senior and I did To the Death, which was a big mega sci-fi opus, somewhat modeled on Dragon's Claws, the series we'd done for Marvel way back in the day. And then my real passion is crime literature fiction, especially that kind of hard-boiled Private Eye Raymond Chandler-esque, which has crept into Transformer stories even. So to do 5 points, Martin Stiff, the artist, had done a quite sort of serious book called Tiny Acts of Violence, set in East, in Cold War Berlin. And that was, I'd loved his style, and I thought this would make a great noir style. And we got together, and I had an idea from, I've been forever pulling up movie ideas, making little notes and things, and I had this crime story with set in this actual borough, or not borough, but place in New York City called 5 Points, which was an old, immigrant community neighborhood. And this idea of, a crime being committed in period 1960s New York and being investigated by this detective, that we would move on into other stories. So, 5 Points is our first one. Martin is hard at work on the second one of these Warren Mackey case files, which is called The Gaia, and that should be out next year. So we're hoping over time we'll have a nice series of these.
Very nice.
Are there any other projects that you're working on right now, or like what's on your plate right now?
I mean, I'm working on more Astrobots. Astrobots
Okay.
is, the trade of the first one comes out in October. Then the second series of five will start, and I'm working on the fourth arc at the moment. So, there's quite a bit of momentum and world building going on over there. I'm working on a new series for Titan Comics at the moment that I don't think has been announced, but very much enjoying that. They've just actually released a weird, strange one. They did a digital comic based on a computer game called Battletoads.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, which, I'd never heard of, but, I duly did my research. And that now has been collected. I think it just come out as a print and paper series. And that was fun little diversion. And yeah, other than that, I'm working on Earth Wars still, the Transformers game, and generally trying to get a few more of my own personal projects up and running.
Good deal. So going to one of your other personal projects from back in the day, have you seen the new Death's Head figure that was made this year?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He's up on my shelf at the moment. So, in fact, all three little Death's Heads are up there now. The Heraclix one, the smaller figure they did a while back, and now the big size one. Looks great.
Yeah, he scales really well with like the Galvatron they did.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just really nice looking figure. Mine's still in its pack at the moment. I must pick up another one so I can have one out of the pack as well.
Oh yeah, 'cause they modeled it after his Marvel card.
Yes, that's right. Yeah,
Yeah.
that trading card that I believe Art Adams drew for a trading card set in the early 90s. But yeah, it's a nice model to take as well.
It's nice to finally get a large size Death's Head.
Yeah, no, very pleased with that. That's very satisfying now.
We're hoping we get the green costume for him so he'll fit in better with the Transformers.
Yeah, I hope so. I think that'd be very cool to have the original costume, which, I still prefer because it was the original,
I like the
character.
red one you did in What If also.
Yes, that sort of really bulked out one that Jeff did. So yes, who knows, we might get some other Death's Heads eventually.
Those would be great. Now I had a question. When you were writing Death's Head's origin story about how he came from Styracos, like what went into that? Did you have any alternate ideas that didn't make it? Like you tossed those out for Lupex and Pyra, or what was the process you went through coming up with his origin?
Yeah, I mean, I think I just didn't want him to be a standard built robot. I wanted there to be, something more to him, maybe, as it turned out, a sort of mystical, magical kind of feel to it. So yeah, I don't think I'd had any, Death's Head's creation was a kind of piecemeal thing. Originally he was just this bounty hunter character for a Transformers story, and then it was like, okay, we need to make him more of a character in his own right. Then his Marvel series is, somewhat different to, how I then looked at, well, let's make this bit more sort of a bit like that thing we were talking about, building of mythology. Let's make him, literally, as it were, more than meets the eye. So he's not just a mechanical being with a personality. He's this, he's almost been imprinted with a personality sort of through mystical means. And I just thought it gave him more of a sort of more arcane edge to him, because he always looked that way, the way Jeff drew him. So I thought it was good to give him a slightly more mystical, magical background.
Oh, it certainly fleshed him out more and it expanded, his world more because, you mainly saw him fighting robots or going after, targets, but that just opened up. It was almost like a Tolkien-esque world you built for him there. Just it surprised me to see the magic side of everything.
And it's going back again to that thing about the character. Death's Head is an interesting character because most characters you're supposed to, move on from where they are when they start the story to where they end. Death's Head technically doesn't do that. He doesn't have character growth. He doesn't have a journey. He's the same at the beginning of as he is the end. He's somewhat like Doctor Who just kind of comes into a story and goes out of it. But for his own graphic novel, I kind of thought he needs to have a personal stake. There has to be more that, he's almost got to find something within himself to, carry on being the character he is. So, again, it was just, he needed more than just here's a couple of loosely connected contracts.
Right, and it showed, I guess, that inner struggle we have with our parents, how we don't want to turn into our parents all the time. So yeah, there's a lot, that whole argument he had with Lupex, like, I'm not you, I'm something completely different, I don't do this for fun. Yeah.
I think that's it. And again, looping back to what I said, it's very much about making something that people recognize in those characters, an emotion, a part of their own life that they can relate to. And I think that's it. We all have our parental rebellion or our issues sometimes, or just, whatever it is, but the family dynamic is always a really good one for some emotional sort of whammy.
Nice. Before we let you go here, I wanted to ask you, are you going to any conventions coming up, any sort of appearances?
Yeah, I've got two more this year. I'm at Thought Bubble, which is a UK convention in the north of England, which will be my first time there. And then very shortly after that, these are both in November, I will be at TF Nation Minicon in Reading, UK, which again is, just a nice, it's like the scaled down. TF UK this year, sorry, TF Nation this year was, a really, really good convention. Everybody had a great time. And, I'm really looking forward to this smaller one day one just to finish off the year.
Yeah, definitely. I've worked at conventions, and sometimes having a more concentrated, smaller, easier to, I guess, work with scheduling and venue, just it feels so nice. It feels a lot more welcome.
Yeah,
So
I love
definitely in that.
I love the social side of conventions as much as
Yeah.
any. So, sometimes the smaller ones, they're more relaxed, more, everyone's more chilled. But it's great. And I think Nick Roach is at the Minicon as well, so I get to hang out with him again for a day or two.
Very nice.
Very good.
Boo, is there anything else you wanted to bring up, or?
No, I think we've covered all the bases here.
All right. Well,
Yeah.
oh, I'm sorry, go
Oh, I was saying, yeah, it was good to talk to you again.
ahead. Likewise, yeah,
Yeah.
I have no idea if that was what we talked about last time exactly, but hey.
Yeah, it was a lot of the same stuff.
Cheers. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to catch lightning in a bottle twice.
Hey, well, thank you so much for coming on with us. This is very enjoyable, and like I told you earlier, like when I talked to Buzz and then talked to Mike Hill, hearing the old stories is something I think that as a longtime fan, we want to make sure it doesn't get lost, and we want to make sure these stories get told, and people know how things started and how they're going, and maybe what's next. So
Yeah,
I definitely appreciate it.
it's been great having a chat.
Yeah, definitely. All right, have a great day, Simon.
Yep,
Yeah, it's
good
good
to
talking
see
to you.
you. Take care now.
All
Bye.
right, thanks. More Than Mises Guys is performed by Evan Johns and Ed Strickland with Boo of the ExcellentUnderground.com. Research is also done by Evan Johns, Ed Strickland, and Boo of the ExcellentUnderground.com. All used images are property of Hasbro, Sunbow, Paramount, and/or Marvel. And without you,
None of this would be possible. So thank you so much for being here, and we look forward to you being here every week.